Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 151, Judaism from a Transgender Perspective. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are thrilled to welcome you to 2019, the year in which we expect our 1 millionth download of Judaism Unbound, actually in just a couple of months. We'll keep you posted about that. And all in all, a really exciting year for us. We're so grateful to all of you who made end-of-year donations, and especially to all of you who answered our listener survey. We'll be following up with you to let you know what we've learned from that survey and what we hope to do going forward, also in the months ahead. As you know, if you've been listening to Judaism Unbound for a long time, our podcast is all about helping our listeners access interesting people and perspectives that they may not always get a chance to encounter. We're especially excited to be able to launch 2019 with a guest who will help us in both of those dimensions. Our guest today is Joy Layden. She is the David and Ruth Gottesman Chair in English at Stern College of Yeshiva University. In addition to being a professor of English, Joy Layden is also an essayist and a poet, and she has written two books of nonfiction that are going to be our focus today. Her first book of nonfiction, a memoir called Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders, told the story of her gender transition and how she built a new life for herself moving forward. Her most recent book is called The Soul of the Stranger, Reading God and Torah from a Transgender Perspective. Joy Layden has written a total of 11 books, including many volumes of published poetry, with titles such as Transmigration, Coming to Life, Impersonation, and most recently, The Future is Trying to Tell Us Something. She also has given a wonderful TEDx talk called Ain't I a Woman, which is available online. Joy Layden holds a PhD in American Literature from Princeton University and has won more awards than we can do justice to in this introduction, which has already gotten quite long. So without further ado, Joy Layden, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's such a great thrill to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, could we just start off by hearing a little bit about your story in your own words for our listeners who are not familiar with it?
I grew up in the 1960s, and like many of what we would now call transgender children at that time, I grew up in hiding and without an awareness that there were other people like me. So from a very early age, this doesn't always happen with trans kids, but from a very early age, I had a sense of female gender identity, but I picked up quite quickly that my sense of myself was not like other people's sense of me. Because there was no acknowledgement that somebody like me could exist, I assumed that this was something that shouldn't be spoken of, that it was a bad thing, that it was a shameful thing, and that I had to hide the fact that I didn't identify as the male that everybody saw me and knew me as. Although I did find out that there were other people like me, I remained afraid for most of my life to actually live my female gender identity. And for me, that fear was, the root of it was a fear that I would be unlovable if people knew me as I was. That was kind of the assumption that I made as a child. Like, don't let your parents know who you really are, because if they know, then they won't love you. They'll see you as something monstrous. And so I kept making the same decision, which was I would rather be loved, even though I didn't feel people were loving me, than be myself and be seen as unlovable. That continued until my mid-40s, when I started breaking down physically and emotionally. I had struggled with suicidal depression all my life. That's also common for trans people. But at this point, I realized I simply couldn't go on living as a man, and I had to decide whether killing myself or gender transition was the better option. And strange as it may seem, that was a really tough choice for me. It wasn't obvious. Other people seemed to feel like that was a no-brainer. But I felt like, yeah, really, there are benefits and drawbacks to both options here. The big thing for me was that I knew that if I started living as myself, I'd come out to my college girlfriend who had been married when we were sophomores. And she had said at the time, and I knew this was true, that as a heterosexual woman, she couldn't be with somebody who didn't look like and act like a man, which I think is reasonable. So I knew that if I couldn't keep living as a man, that would be the end of my marriage. At that point, we had three small children. I would lose my home. And because of this lifelong assumption, I thought I would lose everything else also. Certainly didn't think I would be able to go back and teach at Yeshiva University, which is where I was. So I was hanging on till I could receive tenure. My marriage had fallen apart. It was clear that I couldn't hold on very much longer. And more or less the moment I got tenure, I sent out a coming out letter to my dean. And to my surprise, although it's common practice for organizations that are dealing with their first gender transition, they didn't fire me. They put me on what they called involuntary research leave, which was a brilliant invention. I don't think anybody had thought of forcing an academic to do research on full salary before. So the only condition for me continuing on full salary and benefits with my job title was that I not have anything to do with students. So for many academics, this is like a dream come true.
Right.
But I'd never experienced discrimination before. I really hadn't been an object of anti-Semitism. I was mostly seen as a heterosexual white man. So I didn't know the kind of pain that feeling discriminated against causes. I love teaching at Stern College for Women. That's been fantastic for me. And so this really hurt. As a poet, I'd always seen jobs as just a way to make money to support writing. And given the opportunity to spend the rest of my life making money and writing, it was very strange to me that it hurt. So miraculously, and for reasons that I suspect literally no one knows, after a year, Yeshiva University responded to my attorney's demand letter by saying, "Of course you can come back and teach. We always meant you to come back and teach." They had said over and over again, "You'll never come back and teach." But no, actually, that was a misunderstanding. And so my attorneys lost their vision of a Supreme Court case establishing whether religious organizations can discriminate, because I had just received tenure. I was the dream client. But I got to teach comp and do all the other kinds of work that I loved at the school. So I've been there ever since. But of course, it is different to be there as someone seen as a heterosexual man, which is highly valued by that culture, versus somebody seen as a transgender person, which I think is something that simply is not, Orthodox culture still does not have any slots for those kinds of people. So for most of my students, they either, I think, just see me as other, or they see me as somebody with a serious sexual fetish that I'm trying to drag other people into, or they see me as mentally ill. One creative person opined that I was really a gay man who was transitioning because looking like a woman is a better way to pick up men. So this person doesn't understand gay men either, but it's a great example, like in that culture, it's a very homophobic yeshiva culture for obvious reasons. If you've gotten in with these intense relationships, that's something you need to be thinking about. So he was trying to use that category to understand me. And that's just what people do. We take the templates that our cultures offer us, and we try to understand the messiness of humanity, including our own messiness that presents in terms of those categories, which are always like, they have limitations. As I said, I think the queer cultures also have limitations in their understanding of of somebody like me, and particularly religious queer people often feel like, well, when I go to a queer conference, some parts of me are understood and other parts of me are looked down on. And when I, in religious contexts, it's the reverse.
There's so much in what you're talking about that opens up many, many questions. I wanted to start, though, with a few times you explain, I didn't transition to make myself happy, but I did it in order to live. And I hope that you can elucidate that a little, explain that a little bit for folks.
Yes. As you know, I said in the memoir and in the book that I just published that when my best friend suggested my name should be Joy, I just laughed in her face because I was so miserable. This is like a bad joke to name to say, hi, I'm the most miserable person you've met. My name is Joy. But one of the ways that American culture tries to understand big decisions that human beings make is we try to understand them in terms of happiness. Individual happiness is one of the highest values in the culture. We hold individuals responsible for their level of happiness. We judge and we expect them to judge their success, like have they made the right decisions in terms of whether or not they're happy. Are you happy in your job? Not is your job enabling you to contribute to the world in important and meaningful ways, but are you happy? I'm not saying these are bad questions, but that's often a way that people think about gender transition and trans identities. Why would you make a decision that changes everything in your life? Why would you do that if it's not going to make you happy? So there are many different kinds of people we now gather under the term transgender, and I really only know one of them well, and that's me. So I'm not trying to speak for everybody. But I do think I've heard many times from the kind of trans person that I am, which is people born into and assigned one gender on the basis of their bodies, but strongly identify with the other gender. Many of us hold off on gender transition until it's a matter of life or death. Partly because, and this I think is changing, but when I was growing up, there was simply no way to explain to anybody that I cared about why I would be making this change that would make sense. There's no moral code where you could say, look, morally, I need to do this. If you say, well, I need to be true to myself and honest with other people, most people are like, no, really, we don't need to know this about you. This is TMI. You know, we would much prefer you to act like a gender we understand than do whatever the heck it is you are telling us you need to do. I kept considering this myself. Should I do this? Should I not do it? My culture is like saying, well, will it make you happy? Clearly, it was not going to make me happy. My culture was not valuing. And the first thing my gender therapist asked me, actually, when I started to talk with her about this was, did anyone ever teach you to be true to yourself? And it's striking to me that no, my family didn't teach me to be true to myself. They were, all of us are virtuosos at denial. Like many families, they wanted me to be who I needed to be in terms of other people. Judaism provides the pikuach nefesh idea, which is that if it's a matter of saving your life, there are very few commandments that you shouldn't violate in order to save your life, because you can't actually do any of the other commandments if you're a dead person. The other was that people kept telling me, if you kill yourself, your kids are going to be really messed up and they will be likely to kill themselves. And in fact, I called the therapist in crisis and I said, I just can't go on anymore. And instead of comforting me and, encouraging me the way I had, been looking for, she said, look, you can't kill yourself, because you have to stay alive long enough for your children to reject you. If you kill yourself, they will be frozen in their anger at you and their rage. They'll basically spend the rest of their lives stuck at your grave, raging at you, and that will damage them permanently. And she gave me some scary statistics about how much more likely the children of people who kill themselves are to kill themselves.
Thank you. It's really important to start this next question by saying that, because we can't avoid the topic of suicide in conversations like this. It looms very large, and we avoid it at our own societal perils. So thank you. And it brought to mind for me, just on a personal note, my uncle wrote a book in the 80s called I Thought People Like That Killed Themselves. And at the time he was writing about gay men's experience, and he himself was a cisgender gay man. But and it's not that the issues are exactly the same, but they do relate to one another when we talk about suicide and how it affects both communities of folks who are transgender and folks who are gay or lesbian or bisexual. So thank you. I also wanted to bring up something else that my uncle wrote about because I was sort of thinking along those lines. And that's the subject of religion in queer spaces along with queerness in religious spaces. And it was kind of eerie hearing you speak because it really echoed a piece he wrote in a book called Twice Blessed, which is about being both Jewish and and at the time gay or lesbian. Very transformative for me as a straight white cisgender man to open myself up as a teenager to learning about these kinds of experiences. But anyway, I wanted to open up that religious and queer blending or blurring or whatever verb we're using question, because your book, The Soul of the Stranger, does a beautiful job, I think, of doing some of that work. And I'm trying to identify the right language to ask the question, because I don't want to do it in, I don't want to do your language injustice, because my instinct is to ask, like, how is it that you sort of find the trans narratives or find the trans perspectives, some language like that in Torah? Because, and that's in a sense what this book is about. But I don't want to imply that the Torah isn't itself, doesn't contain those stories already, because I know you speak about that. But so, long story short, what was this book, The Soul of the Stranger? What was the verbing that it did, and how does it help us understand the queer and the Jewish experience in our tradition?
When I started living as myself and I started talking about trans experience, because my the attention that I got really was mostly because of the strange quality of having a trans person at an Orthodox Jewish university. So a huge proportion of the speaking that I've done has been in Jewish contexts, and often about the relation between trans and Jewish identities. And I found that people found this a really strange idea. Many people would say, how can you reconcile these or put these together? And that was, at first, I didn't even understand the question. They'd never been apart for me. And I was so lonely. But having an experience, no matter how strange, of connection with anyone, even, you know, I mean, God is not a very good playmate if you're 6 or 7 years old. Really not a good playmate. But nonetheless, if God's the only person you have to pal around with, I had a strong personal motivation to develop that. And so that's one thing. The other thing is the trans experience of being different, which gave me this motivation not to discount the perception of God's presence. And the third thing was, although my parents weren't religious, my mother has a very strong sense that being Jewish means something. And for my mother and her family, it mostly means ethnic stuff, which I've never related to. So I was, you know, my Jewishness was questioned by my family because I hate gefilte fish, for example. Like, there are all these ethnic Ashkenazic signifiers that I didn't relate to. But because being Jewish meant something to my mother, she connected our family to a synagogue, sent me to a Hebrew school. And when I was in synagogue, I had texts that referred to God. So my Jewish identification didn't come with an institutionalized religion, but it led me into a religious tradition. And I immediately said, oh, other people have perceived God. And so, but because my family and my synagogue was weird also in ways I don't need to talk about, but I was really doing this without religious guidance. I just, you know, I read prayers and I'm like, oh yeah, God, got that. And I read the Torah and I immediately thought, wow, fantastic. There's a book about people like me that is all about a character who, like me, doesn't have a body to make them visible and intelligible to the people that they want to have relationships with and that they love. And as a young child, I think, you know, we are blessed with boundless narcissism. So the, you know, it never occurred to me to say, you can't analogize yourself to God. As I mentioned in the book, it's a good thing that Moses Maimonides wasn't hanging around my synagogue and warning me against the kind of naive identification that I was making. So I carried that sense that these things all go together, this human spiritual capacity to perceive God, or the different cultures name this stuff in different ways. For me, that was God, the Jewish tradition that offered stories and texts that helped me give shape about to this and see what other people made of God. And so these different elements of my life and self, to me, fit together seamlessly, and they literally kept me alive. If I had not felt that I had that relationship with God, and that that was something that I shared, at least theoretically, with other people, I don't see how I would have made it out of childhood. As it was, I tried to kill myself a couple of times. So I would read these passages, and I would see God, and I would relate to the difficulties God was having in relating to human beings. I think many other people come from religious traditions that are like, you know, God's good at everything. God's great at everything. And so it's very puzzling when you read the Torah and you see God just screwing up or not being able to communicate clearly, or decreeing things that don't happen. These create huge theological problems. And to me, those were not theological problems. I also didn't struggle with the idea that God was, you know, all good and that everything God did was good, because I knew that the way that I had been created, I did feel created by God. That was a really incredible feeling. I was so different from people that I was pretty sure I was handmade. You know? There was no assembly line rolling off people like me. But I was made in a way that was excruciatingly painful. And that was part of the package. If I wanted to feel created by God, I had to accept that I was created in ways that hurt and that were difficult and that involved suffering. And so I didn't have this ideology of an all good, all everything God. And a series of unlikely events meant that I had a sabbatical, and I was invited by the Hadassah Brandeis Institute to submit a research fellowship application. And that requires you to submit a book proposal. I had no book in mind, but I got to come up with something. Well, what have I been writing about lately? All this, you know, stuff about Torah and God. All right. So I threw together a book proposal. I had no idea what I was really doing with that. And then I got a phone call from the National Endowment for the Arts telling me that I had been awarded a writing fellowship. And I thought that was great, because my poetry had never been recognized with any award or anything. And I was quite surprised to realize that wasn't what I was being awarded for. It was actually a creative nonfiction award. And I didn't even remember applying for that. I literally blanked. I think I just, you know how sometimes when you're a writer, stuff comes into your inbox. You're like, oh yeah, I should do something like that. And then you just forget about it. So I had forgotten that I had applied. I wouldn't have noticed if I didn't get it. And so I got the Hadassah Brandeis Award. I got the NEA grant. So clearly, I had to be writing a book of nonfiction. Because of the NEA, it couldn't be an academic book. It had to be creative nonfiction. I had told Hadassah Brandeis I was doing an academic book. And so that all of those things came together. I was like, okay, I've got to write this book. And it can't just be an academic book. And so I'll draw on the stuff that I've read. And it'll be about reading Torah from a transgender perspective. That should be easy for me, because I've always read the Torah from a transgender perspective. So this was a really evolving process. And my orientation, starting with the academic proposal to Hadassah Brandeis Institute, was really problematic, because one of the lovely things about academic writing is you armor yourself, you hide yourself behind quotations from other people. You don't have to say, well, I relate to God as a living presence. You say, as so-and-so and so-and-so have said, people often relate to God as a living presence and blah, 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 and blah, 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 this is, you know. So I tried to do that, but it was a mess. And Rabbi Burton Vysotsky, who teaches at the Jewish Theological Seminary, he was the one who had been encouraging me to write a book like this. And I asked him, how do you think I should write it? And he said, write it so that the widest possible audience can read it. And when I went back to that, I was like, oh no, the widest possible audience means that I can't use all of the devices academics use to protect ourselves, to pretend we're not saying what we're saying, we're ventriloquizing through other sources. If I wanted to write to as many people as possible, I had to strip all that away and try to tell the truth in the most direct way that I could. And I had to find the aspects of my truth, because I'm the only person that I really know about this. And I had to try to ferret out the parts of my experience that also related to other readers of biblical text experience, other trans people's experience. But I couldn't base though that claim of commonality on what anybody else had said. The sense of differentness that made it easy for me to read the Torah and relate to God made it really, really hard and scary to say, yeah, this thing I think is something that I have in common with other people. So as I rewrote the book, I was really revising my whole life and my whole understanding of myself. And that's why the book ends up in a place of, I hadn't thought of this before, but realizing that critiquing my own childhood ideas of distinctiveness in my relationship with God. And I had to realize that, yeah, actually when we're relating to God, the differences that seem so big to us, they certainly define my whole life, that sense of difference, they're nothing.
I'm particularly struck by, at least in my reading of your book, of your memoir and this book about reading the Torah, you act as kind of a mediator for, I think, many of us who are not trans to understand God in a better way, in a different way, because we do have friends and loved ones who are trans and can sort of make that leap in an easier way because you've built that bridge for us. And I was struck by the moment in your memoir when you are kind of raging at God and you say, you don't know what it is to be rejected by your children. And then you pause for a minute, say, oh, yeah, now I actually get it. Right. And specifically for me, the other part that really struck me was in the Soul of the Stranger, when you're talking about God and you talk about how in Jewish tradition, we're very comfortable with the idea that, yes, of course, God is not a physical being like we usually are, but nevertheless, we'll use gendered language to talk about God, and we'll have various metaphors and images of God that are human. And we understand that we have to do that because we are human, and it's the only way that we can access God. And you sort of present that as a version of what's been happening to trans people throughout history. And that in some ways we're doing a terrible injustice to God by not allowing God to be who God is. And you talk about how it's actually not fair of humans to not accept God's own understanding of God's self. So I'd love to hear a little bit more from you about how you think your experience and your perspective really does for you shape an understanding of God that's deeper than perhaps is available to many others, and then how you sort of try to translate that for those of us who haven't had the experiences that you've had.
So like many trans people, my hunch is most trans people, but I've never done a survey, but I think it's a common thing for trans people to say, wow, the people that I love and am relating to can't really understand me because the culture, the language, the categories that we have available for ways of understanding people, the roles that are based on gender and assumptions about it, they just don't work for someone like me. I think it does feel unfair. Why isn't society set up to understand me? I think, you know, that would be lovely if cultures were in fact individually tailored to the needs of individual people. As a trans person, I felt peculiarly poorly served by my culture, and that I was always having to choose between being in relation to people and being who I was, which would render me incomprehensible. So those were in tension with each other. And it was constant trade-offs. For God, those trade-offs are absolute. So it sucks that we can't understand God in God's own terms, but that is the definition of being human. That's where Maimonides comes into the book, because Maimonides thinks in an incredibly sustained way about what it means to have a being at the center of your tradition, of your religion, of your life, that anytime you try to understand that being in any way, you have done a terrible injustice to God. So Maimonides, I think, pushes that as far as it can go. And so one of the things that I realized when I was writing this book was that the way I was, this common denominator way of defining transgender, I didn't want to just talk about being a transsexual of my generation. I wanted to male to female. So I thought, okay, it has to be like anybody who's something more complex that everybody can recognize parts of themselves that don't fit into the cultural categories that are available. And then I realized, well, you know, actually, if you believe as I do, and this is weird because I don't know what this means when it says God creates human beings in God's own image. I have no idea what that means. That is a Jewish koan, as far as I'm concerned. You take a being that has no image and say you're created in that image. Like, that is the sound of one hand clapping Jewishly. So, but I nonetheless believe that this is true. So there must be some part of human beings, despite how different we are from God, there must be some part of us that is really like God. And I don't believe it's human reason. Human reason has been taken down many pegs thanks to things like the Holocaust and corporate efficiency and thing, you know, monstrous misuses of reason. So as I was working on this, I thought, oh, the part of us that must be akin to God must be the part that, like God, doesn't fit into human categories. We have that incomprehensibility, which is why nobody is going to seamlessly fit inside human categories. And that means that at a root level, every human being has this incomprehensible vastness. Trans people and other people who are queer are forced to recognize that because the categories fit us so badly. You know, so for me to identify as trans is saying there's a huge part of me that doesn't fit into these categories. And it's so big, I got to wreck my life and relationships in order to live that and then just see what happens. But I do believe that there is just no human being that is so simplistic that we fit into human categories. That is why I ended up feeling like I did want to make a bridge between trans and non-trans people here, because I was hoping everybody would recognize that we're always making this choice about, is it more important for us to be absolutely who we are? Because if you're with other people, relating to them is going to cost you some measure of your individuality and spontaneity and impulse. But if you love people and if you want to be loved, if you want to be understood, if you want to be part of community and intimate relationships and friendships, it's a trade-off we make all the time.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're bringing around that trade-off. It's a defining trade-off that I think about a lot, the individual identity and the belonging in a group. I think that it's a huge Jewish, ironically enough, binary individual group. But it's one that comes up all over. And when I reflect about myself, I actually have come to think maybe, and like you said, I only know me. I don't know anybody else really fully. But for me, it feels that I have a striving towards that unique individualness that sometimes clouds out my striving for the belonging in a group. And that does, in fact, lead me in certain respects to
not be alone in the sense of not having a, but to what is it? March to the beat of my own drummer. And I've actually found in Judaism a beautiful tradition that helps me on occasion do that, march to my own drummer, that has for most been like entirely out of style for a few thousand years, but it's a ritual that you talked about in your book, which is the Nazirite vow. Because I've actually taken a couple Nazirite vows, and I've taken them for 30 days at two different points. And that's the period that the Mishnah talks about is a 30-day sort of default. So you can also do it for your whole life. But I wanted to open up to you this question of the Nazirite vow, because I think along the thread you're bringing up of individual and group identities, the Nazirite really brings some beautiful questions to light. And you brought them up very persuasively in your book. So what is this Nazirite vow, and how does it connect to questions of being trans, Jewish, and otherwise?
First of all, I have to say that I'm having like a sort of a fangirl moment. Oh, I'm talking to somebody who's taken a Nazirite vow. That's really thrilling. Wow. So that is fantastic. And when I was writing that section, I've never been part of any synagogue I just don't remember anybody talking about this except as a historical artifact. And I know that it's a living tradition for some people, but I just never encountered it that way. So I felt like I was really going out on a limb there. And that was an example of something that that was not a way that I had read the Torah all my life or as a child. The Nazirite vows, part of them is you abstain from any contact with any part of a grape plant and any kind of grape product. So no raisins, no wine, no stems. No. So if you are part of a culture where grape growing is a big aspect of that culture, and in fact, part of the Jewish vision of messianic days is everybody's sitting under their own vine. So that's how central this agricultural product is to the culture, saying you can't have it. And you can't, not only can't have it, but can't be anywhere near it or have any contact with it, is going to really disrupt a lot of social relations. Maybe you don't come from a grape growing family. If you do, your family is really screwed. Suddenly they've lost a worker. You can't, market the stuff. You can't be involved in cooking the stuff. If you're a woman, that's going to mess things up. But even if your family doesn't have those kinds of relationships with it, you can't go over to people's houses and have wine or grape juice or, you can't make Kiddush. It's at least as disruptive as having a gluten intolerance used to be, right? We've had to develop a whole industry. And at that point, there was no capitalism to say, yeah, we've got to serve the Nazirite community and make grape substitutes. They look like grape products, but they are not grape products. So these vows are designed to say this is an individual who is putting their personal relationship with God, whatever that might be. It's completely not spelled out in the Nazirite vow. Could be different for every single Nazirite. But they're saying it's more important for me to relate to God than it is for me to relate to human beings. I thought, that sounds a lot like what I was seen as saying by, say, my wife, when I said, I need to live my female gender identity. And she said, you're willing to disrupt our entire lives in order to do what you call being true to yourself. And she wasn't wrong. That is what I was doing. I understood it in a different way than she did, but that's also what I think Nazirites would have been doing. It is terrible to Nazirites are prohibited from having any contact with dead bodies or participating in funeral rites. So if a member of your family dies and you say, I'm sorry, my relationship with God, my vow to God, makes it impossible for me to do any of the human things. I love you dearly, but I'm not going to help bury you. That is a way, that's a clear way that the tradition is saying, yeah, human beings, in order to have a relationship, the Torah connects it with relationship to God, mostly, I think, because that's all the Torah really cares about. When it comes to human beings, the Torah is most interested in how whatever we do affects our relationship with God. So I think the Torah, there is a value for honesty, but it's in the context of relationship with God. God commands you to have equal weights and measures. It's not an economic theory that if everybody's cheating everybody else, the economy starts to function poorly and you'll have economic crashes because there's so much fraud in the system. That is a good reason to have equal weights and measures in your business, but that's not the Torah's reason. The Torah's reason is God wants you to do this. So God is sanctifying honest business relations and saying when you violate that, you are cutting yourself off from God. So with regard to this individual self-determination, I didn't see the Torah saying anywhere, people just need to be true to themselves. It doesn't say that. But it does often say that people need to be true to themselves for the sake of their relationships with God. Abraham is not a Nazirite. He couldn't have been because those laws didn't exist. But he completely disrupts his family and violates all of his obligations to his elderly father and to other people by following God into the wilderness. There's no human justification for that behavior. But clearly, that is the truth that Abraham felt he needed to pursue. Your relationship with God is sometimes going to need you to do things that seem crazy and wrong, or at least massively inconvenient to the human beings around you. You're going to have to violate their rules and categories and expectations, and they're not going to understand why you're doing it, because you're doing it for the sake of a relationship with a being who doesn't make any sense.
As I have been reading your work that helps us look at the material of the Jewish past in a new way through a trans perspective, it got me thinking, as I always am, about the Jewish present and thinking about how to understand and interpret elements of it from a trans perspective, both in terms of understanding it better and perhaps understanding a little bit based on what trans people have gone through and how they've dealt with some of these things, as to maybe there's some wisdom there for all of us. I'm thinking about it this way, that there's a similarity to the way that a lot of contemporary American Jews, at the very least, are experiencing Judaism, I think. Because I think that they have an impulse that the way that we've been taught to be Jewish isn't right, doesn't work for us. It doesn't feel right to me. I don't feel good in it. I don't want to leave it. I imagine that there's another way to be Jewish that's more compelling, but nobody has told me about it. And that the truth is that we're sort of experiencing the same kind of pain and confusion that comes out of knowing that our present circumstance is not right, but we don't really know what it looks like on the other side. And I'm just sort of wondering if there are ways in which you see that as right, and that you've sort of experienced elements of that yourself, but whether you have or you haven't, you know, what wisdom is there in your experience and the trans experience to think about Judaism itself as being perhaps in a time of transition and struggling and not knowing what you're supposed to do in that kind of situation?
That moment in the Jewish present has been recurring in different forms, at least since the Enlightenment. But I have a feeling, yeah, if you look at the post-Temple days, I mean, there are various places, points where you can see lots of Jews saying, huh, this isn't working anymore. But there is a way that American Jews now, and for some time, I think, have thought about things in exactly the people who care. So for my family, like, my father was not interested enough in Jewishness to care whether or not it made sense to him or fit. Like, there was this things, weird things you would do every so often, and it made his wife happy, and it didn't bother him that much. So during a Seder, he would wear his kippah at an extreme angle. At any moment, that kippah might fall off. So you better read the Seder very quickly, because if the kippah falls off, I don't know. To me, that was a symbol like everything was over. So that was his relation. But for people, there are many people who have said to me and clearly expressed that the form of Judaism they've been given, have been told, is theirs. They've been told, you're a Jew. And they say, oh, I'm a Jew. That means I must be able to understand and express myself in terms of whatever being a Jew means. And then they look at what being a Jew means in their local context and like, huh, that's funny, this isn't meeting my needs at all. So, for example, there are many forms of Judaism that do a terrible job of addressing individual suffering. And I think that that's one reason that a lot of the best American Buddhists are Jews. There was a 19th century rabbi I've been quoting for years, but I have no idea what the name of this rabbi is. You know, so you just say a rabbi and everybody accepts that for some reason. But the quote that I saw that I glommed onto was, anyone who doesn't feel that they're in exile is not really awake. For that rabbi, that sense of I'm here, I'm supposed to be able to make a life here, but it just doesn't feel right. I don't have what I need to make sense of myself and my life. For him, that was a basic condition of humanity, of spiritual awakeness. You have to have that sense of dissatisfaction. I was certainly never taught, and I think a lot of Jews are never taught in America, that you're allowed to do something with that. That, you know, Judaism has been around for 3,000 years. Literally nobody knows everything that has been Jewish. And that means that nobody knows everything that could be Jewish. Any version of Jewishness we've been taught is just a teeny little edited selection. So if you don't like it, you're just scratching the surface. You know, none of the categories for trans people, you know, there are 64, 128, whatever it is, however many Facebook comes up with, they will never be enough. So maybe what we will all end up with is, yeah, we'll have nouns, but it'll be like, if you really want to know about me and my gender, you need to sit still while I tell you a story. And I think that that is what this sense of dissatisfaction with what it means to be a Jew is summoning us to do. It's saying, you should be dissatisfied because whatever you're thinking of as Jewish right now, it's just a moment in your story. And it's not just your story. Jewishness, Jewish civilization, Judaism as a spiritual practice, Jews as a people, Jews as an essential part of the spiritual DNA of humanity. We need your dissatisfaction to keep leading you from one point to another, because it is your dissatisfaction that gives meaning to these different forms of Jewishness.
Whoa. In so many ways, I think you encapsulated what this project of Judaism Unbound is trying to do in terms of stoking that dissatisfaction and acting on the dissatisfaction. So just thank you. But as we close, really open-ended, just are there any things we haven't been able to touch on yet? Any ideas, any thoughts, any parts of your book, anything that that you'd want to leave our listeners with? I mean, I'd name that we just have a ton of folks listening who are themselves trans, and we very regularly, we always end our episodes by calling for feedback and questions and whatever. And we are in touch with folks who themselves identify as trans, which means a lot to us. But just to those folks or to all our listeners, cisgender, transgender, you know, with one foot in each, however it might be, what are some parting thoughts for them as this episode closes?
I think what I want most to say is how grateful I am that your starting assumption was also one of the things that I hoped would be demonstrated by the book. The book that I wrote is really meant to be the starting point, because all I have to work with is this tiny little one person's set of experiences and readings. My hope is that by the end of the book, many people will say, oh, being trans is one of the flavors of being human. Being a trans Jew is one of the flavors of being a Jew. And like every other way of being human or being Jewish, it has perspectives and insights to offer. And once we recognize the humanity of trans people, those insights don't only belong to trans people, because we recognize you as human. That means your insights are actually available to us, as long as we're willing to stretch our definition of humanity so that we don't other you. We get to have the benefit of whatever trans experience offers as Jews, as religious people, as human beings. And I feel like that was your premise from the beginning of this conversation, and I'm deeply grateful for that.
Thank you so much, Troy Layden, for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
And thanks so much to all of you out there listening. We really appreciate you tuning in, and we hope that you'll do so in the future. We want to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us, and there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we really deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation you're able to set aside for us. And you can do that either on a monthly recurring basis or a one-time gift at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.